super strong, supernatural, and super bad. His punch can topple a skyscraper. His kick can split the earth in two. More destructive than an earthquake. Mightier than a tidal wave. A one-man disaster area.
42nd Street Pete.
Shot full of lead and he still ain't dead. Jump back, Jack, for your skull is cracked.
42nd Street Pete.
Hey, welcome back to the Grindhouse, and we have a very special guest this week, a guy who I met back in my chiller theater days, probably a guy who has accomplished more in this business than anybody ever, as far as I'm concerned, working, and his titles, Grindhouse titles, are legendary. The Corpse Grinders, Blood Orgy of the She Devils, the Astro Zombies. The Grindhouse would like to welcome Ted B. Michaels to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I remember when we did meet many years ago, Pete, and of course I really do appreciate that. Was quite an introduction. What I do find, though, even on IDMB and any of the other, even on my own website, there's an enormous number of pictures that I did that aren't even mentioned, and I run into them all the time. In fact, as I just got wind of one the other day, hey, I shot that, I made that movie, but a lot of times I didn't put my name on movies because I didn't think it was important. I had enough credits by the time, gosh, even by the time I did Astro Zombies, and then especially after Doll Squad, after that, I didn't think I ever needed another credit. I didn't even put my name on Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, and I put up money and released it. I was executive producer, flew into Miami Beach to show the guys how to light night effect shots, like hands coming out of the dirt in the cemetery, all that kind of stuff. But I didn't even put my name on that. I went on tours with it and had people in manacles, it was a very ugly dug up from the dirt people. Alan Holmes, we made masks and we sent them around to the theaters. And then, of course, on Corpse Grinders, we send out blood pressure kits. And I've still got a few boxes of those old-fashioned squeeze-the-bulb blood pressure kits that we used to send out to every theater.
Wow, we should get a couple of those.
People don't know the depth of your involvement in some of this stuff, too. Because I remember the story you had told us up at Cinema Wasteland about you actually saving children who shouldn't play with dead things because they had screwed up a bunch of stuff on it.
Well, I made them throw away the whole first week of shooting. When I flew there, the guy took me, Gary Gotch took me from the airport. He was going to take me to the set. I said, no, take me to the lab. I want to see what you've done. So, unfortunately, I sat in the lab at midnight watching everything they did for the first week, and I said, you have to throw it in the garbage can. It is no good. I will pull out if you don't reshoot and start over. And God bless them, they did. And we ended up with a nice little movie. But I got to okay all the cuts as it went. I was at Columbia Picture Studios, and my offices there when I flew into Miami to help them and so on. But there's a lot of other miscellaneous movies that are kicking around out there that I don't have a name on. But people don't forget Doll Squad. They don't forget 10 Violent Women. Mission Killfast is a different type of movie, a martial arts action against terrorists. And then Dimension in Fear is more of a psychological terror. And then after that was a Corpse Grinders 2 and Female Slayer's Revenge and The Cauldron, Baptism of Blood and Mark of the Astro Zombies and Demon Heart of a Boy. The list goes on. But even I forget some of the movies that I've done, even though most of them take the better part of a year. Demon Pawn took almost 2 years because of all the CGI. But
yeah, you just keep going and going. And the weird thing was what actually prompted this interview was I had gotten an email from somebody that sent me to a link that was some paper that was published out by you in Vegas, and basically painting a real dismal picture of something that happened to you. And I know a bunch of fans had, you know, concerned about that. And I called you up to, you know, find out what was going on. And you had told me, you know, that basically, you know, what had happened, that this guy wasn't a fan of your work, didn't know the business, and pretty much, you know.
Actually, he had just met a guy that was in from Germany. And the guy that was here from Germany was did the 800-page book outlining the best places to stay in the States. And of course, he spent time in Vegas. And he just happened to accidentally meet this guy. but that guy is not a fan of movies, and I wasn't appreciative. Nothing happened to me. I closed the studio, and because of everybody in the world making a movie now, the distributors are overwhelmed and can't even look at them all. So, and you don't get advances anymore, and I went into debt deeply, you know, half cash and half else, $400,000 on Demon Hunt, and people are doing movies for $2,000 and $3,000. So, you know, you don't compare those to a $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 movie, even like Mission Kill Fast, $700,000. So, you know, what happens is you build enormous debts. And so these debts are what happened to me is debts. So after 18 years and not needing the studio any longer, and then since all of the linear stuff, the Beta SP and all that, I had just a huge bay with probably $250,000 worth of editing stuff in there. Everything from vector scopes to you name it, you know, everything from mixing and of course, editing controllers and effects generators and all that. But when the linear stuff went out, gosh, there was no longer a need for a big studio. And now, of course, I'm shooting with a Z1U. I love it. It's light. I can carry it in one hand. One hand, beautiful stabilizer, shooting high def, 1080i, 29.97 or whatever I want, has a film look. And I'm getting beautiful stuff. And the camera's so great that Clint Eastwood took several of them to, when he shot, I think it was the Philippines, Letters from Iwo Jima, you know, and then they transferred that to 35. But I don't think I'll be transferring anything to 35 because there are literally hundreds of movies out there where they've spent anywhere up to and above $100 million that can't even get a theatrical release. So, you know, what's the point in having 35 millimeter anymore? So my 35 millimeter cameras are they're done, meaning I've got them in storage right now. I did send my big Mitchell and all the lenses. You know, it's a funny thing that one of my friends in Hollywood asked me about the lenses for my Mitchell because I had 7 lenses. And he said he was trying to buy some Zeiss lenses, and they were asking in Hollywood, I don't know who was asking, but anyway, the best buy he could find was 4 of those lenses for $100,000, you know, so they could be used on the RED camera. Well, my lenses from the Mitchell with an adapter can be used on the RED camera, but I shipped the whole bailiwick, the whole Mitchell, all the magazines, the power supplies, crystal sink drive motor, all that stuff to a place called Pro Film Vid in Dallas, and they're mounting it up in their showroom, and let's see what can happen with the lenses and all.
Wow.
But I still have the Noglas and the I got 3 Aeroflexes. And unfortunately, I literally gave away my whole 35 millimeter edit bay in the studio. That was a whole room by itself. And I had a wall of sound effects that was 8 feet high and 12 feet long, and it had hundreds of boxes of what I used was trim boxes, but on the outside of the box, it would say doors, for example. I had, I don't know how many, 6 or 8 boxes of doors. And people say, well, why so many boxes of doors? I said, well, in sound effects, you've got bedroom doors, front doors, heavy doors, light doors, screen doors, barn doors, fence doors, jail doors. You got every sort of it. And so my library was extensive beyond anything you could imagine. Even these, right now, these digital libraries, I had 60 years of sound effects. Guess what? Garbage can. I feel badly about that, saving them all those years in dumpster. But that's what happened to me. I got rid of all that stuff and got rid of the, you know, $2,000 to $3,000 a month overhead on the studio. We had shot everything we needed for Astro Zombies M3 cloned on the sets that we had built in there. Couldn't see any reason to continue on with that heavy, heavy overhead and bringing me deeper and deeper in debt, and that's why the guy in the article says I'm broke. Well, I'm broke making movies to entertain people, of course. But, you know, anybody in the arts goes through that. It doesn't matter whether you're painting pictures or what. And or any art. Writers, I've got writer friends that are really struggling to eat, and yet they've been writing all their life and have many published books and novels. So in the arts, that's what you face. That's what the young people now trying to make a movie will learn the hard way. They, you know, as somebody asked me on an interview recently, do I think the young people are just doing these movies to make a fast buck? And to laugh, a fast buck in the movie business? Come on!
We have nowhere to put them. I mean, the thing was, back in the day, we had a lot of independent theaters that people would own, and those have all been either closed down or bought up or turned into a multiplex and taken over by AMC or somebody. We had drive-ins, which were amazing for your product because you know that you could get them on the circuit and they'd go from drive-in to drive-in. You could make a little money back. Of course, you had to fight the distributors at the time, but you were distributing a lot of your own stuff, Ted.
I had my own distribution company. I had seven people working for me. I flew around the country on occasions to set what we called the promotion for a date, the fact that we told the theaters what to print on a Wednesday, what to print on a Thursday, what to print on a Friday, the size of the ad, radio spots, TV spots.
Wow.
I supplied all that, and if I didn't go very often, I would send somebody who worked for me, and we played not just drive-ins. That seemed to be a misnomer. We played an enormous number of hard tops.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they called hard top flagship theaters, because they made a lot of money on my stuff.
On 42nd Street, it was all in the grindhouses up there.
Yeah, unfortunately, and, I never got the money from a lot of those from distributors who are a little bit difficult to describe in kind words, you know. But
I could probably point out to them the Brandt Brothers and stuff, those guys, you know, never paid anybody.
Well, in any event, I stopped going to the shows when about 1977 at Showarama in Kansas City, where I used to go to all these shows, and I'd see Roger Corman and all these people there, but I would sit and have drinks after hours, and I'd hear the people that had the drive-ins and had the hard tops saying, "Well, you know, we're opening two more theaters. You know, we got money here. There's no point in sending it right back to the independent filmmakers because they can't do anything about it, so we may as well use their money, and we'll give them their money when we get around to it." And that made me, I felt so bad when I got home. I say, "I hope all these theaters close." Because that was really a cheat. As an independent, you don't have any clout. And they would say, "Well, we have to do the majors, even with their 90% after recoup of the house gross, you know, the house cost." And but they'd still, they would have to pay the majors because the majors said, "If you don't give us some money right now, you're not going to get any more of our product." With, as an independent, you're lucky to put out a picture a year, two pictures a year. They don't care about you. And so I had a grudge right then and there when I heard theater people talking that way.
CP, that's what I say about Kansas City. They're still that way here. As a matter of fact, you can't even get your movies here right now. I have to go out to like the smaller areas around Kansas City because Kansas City has this big push with the Baptists, and they got all the horror movies taken out of all the chains here.
You're kidding.
No, all the Best Buys got rid of them. So I have to go clear to like St. Joe, Missouri, or way out past Independence to get the stuff, even way out in Kansas, because it's funny. You can go to a small town, Lawrence, Kansas. They have horror movies everywhere. But Kansas City itself, the home of the porno theater, as I call it, because we still got tons of those, but you can't buy a horror movie in this town.
Oh, isn't that incredible?
Sad.
I just talked with my friend Steve Kaplan at oldies.com, and he keeps telling me, you know, they've had my contract now for a couple of years, and then a little less than a year ago, they had seven more of my movies. They've got a total of 15 of mine at oldies.com, and he keeps telling me, your stuff is selling. We're selling the five-pack, the six-packs, and we're tickled pink. You're one of our best sellers.
It's true.
And, you know, the funny part about it is that some of my movies are, you know, like Corpse Grinders and Mark of the Ass, even The Cauldron, but Doll Squad, my God, Doll Squad is, what, 45 years old, something like that? And it's still a big, and Ten Violent Women is coming up to turn out to be a big seller, as is Blood Orgy of the She-Devil. So, I don't know, you can't really... I guess I can't complain when some of my movies are that old and they're selling better than a lot of the brand new movies, and especially the $100 million movies. So, but we don't have the kind of money to put out a campaign to sell them that they do. But
we love your stuff. Your stuff has heart.
I'll tell you something, though. This is a true story. This actually happened last summer. I was involved with Wild Eye Releasing. We were running grindhouse shows over at the last freestanding theater in East Village, the Pioneer Theater. And one night they were going to run the Corpse Grinders on 35. So somebody said, "Well, you know, it's a shame we can't get Ted out here." And I just said, "Why don't you just call him on the cell phone and put it on speaker?" So the theater manager actually did that, and, you know, they called Ted. Ted did a little Q&A for about, it was like a half hour, right?
It was, Pete, and that was a delightful time, too, for me.
And the best part was, there was an empty seat in the house. And you know how hard it is to get anybody off their ass in New York to do anything? The place was packed. They reacted the same way I reacted when I first saw it. I first saw the Corpse Grinders it was the Corpse Grinders, the Undertaker and his pals, and the Embalmer.
The Embalmer. Yep. As a distributor, I bought the rights for the Embalmer from Allied Artists. I had to pay him. I paid him $25,000 just for the right to do it. Then I had to buy prints at $1,600 a piece to match my prints of Corpse Grinders and Undertaker so that we could have the triple, you know, the trilogy, Final Dimension and Shock. But that was the wisest move because that particular combination, Pacific Drive-Ins and there's a bunch of them, Amco, was it? Well, anyway, they said, well, they'd never play a triple bill. But I had a good sales manager. He was not tough, but he was smart. He said, that's okay. We have a lot of use for our prints across the country. Then when the grosses started coming in, then Pacific and what's the other one? America, AMC, whatever. They called and they said, okay, we'll play it. And guess what? They made so much money. And the Commonwealth Theaters had, 267 theaters in their chain, most of which were hardtops. And I have a letter in hand that I still use when anyone asks me. They said they made more money off of Ted Michaels' Corpse Grinders and Dimension of Shock than any movie they had in that year from the majors or otherwise at any price.
That's
so
awesome.
I guess I've had my days. I did make money then because as a distributor, the money came directly back to me and my company, even though I had a heavy payroll with seven people and so on. But it kept us going for several years. So
I'll tell
anyway,
you
it would be nice that...
Well, Cinema had you, too. I was working for General Cinema, I think.
General Cinema.
That would have to have been 72 because that's when Corpse Grinders was out, I believe.
That's correct. The Bakersfield, one of the big drive-ins there, the only movie that I was told they ever booked on percentage more than once was Corpse Grinders, and they booked it on percentage six times because they knew it was a moneymaker. They made money in the concession stand. They had packed attendance, and normally once you play any theater the first time, you're on a percentage. Second time after that, you're on a flat, $25, $30 for a week, whatever, and you can't ever do anything but destroy your prints. Which brings me to another point. I get calls constantly, would I like to show this movie or Dallas Glot or Ten Violent Women or whatever in such and such a theater or a showcase for Ted Michaels movies? And I said, I do not have, even after spending my life paying off $500,000 in 35mm prints, I don't have any.
Wow.
And that's ugly. If a theater can't project digitally, nothing I can do. I don't have any prints. They all disappeared. Any 35mm prints, Dolls Club prints, Ten Vile, any of those prints, Blood Orgy, anything that's kicking out there, I paid for, but I don't have any. And anybody that's got them, they've actually got my property, but there's nothing I can do about it.
I tell you what's really weird about that. Here in Kansas City, we had an old Revival theater. There's about a 600-seater, one of those really beautiful old theaters. And we're projecting this thing on this. I'd been down in the vault, and I'd stumbled across an old rusty can. And when I opened it up, it had the Corpse Grinders in it. And I said, we're going to watch the Corpse Grinders. So I invited like five of my friends to come up at midnight. You know, we just did this on the weekends after the theater closed. We'd watch an old print of something. We had like the, you know, adult Alice in Wonderland and goofy stuff we'd watch. So we pulled out the Corpse Grinders. And this was like the second time ever I'd put a movie together. This was way back when I first started working there. And the five friends I told brought more people. We ended up with like over 50 people there to watch this movie because everyone wanted to see the Corpse Grinders. And I put it together. And halfway through the movie, the damn thing went upside down and backwards because I didn't know how to put a movie together very well.
Oh, no.
And so I had to,
that's awful.
I had to run upstairs and stop everything and get it fixed. And wow, it was a lot of fun. But I tell you what, it was a main memory because of the fact that usually there'd only be four or five, maybe 10 of us show up to watch these in the middle of the night. You know, it was just for fun. And because here I have this theater at my disposal. Of course, I'm going to watch this crazy. We watch Grave of the Vampire and stuff, but Corpse Grinders was the only one that I ended up with that many people. Even Texas Chainsaw didn't bring that many people when I found an old print of that.
Isn't that delightful to hear that? You know, when they invited me to a Grand House thing in Phoenix, and they showed Corpse Grinders and Doll Squad, and I think I've told a number of people the applause. I was out front, you know, and then I'd speak in the theater at near the end of each one, and of course look at people's reactions, and the thunderous applause, clapping, foot stomping, screaming, whistling, it actually brought tears to my eyes to know that 40 years later, these people were still getting that much of a charge and that much pleasure out of my old movies. I was just tickled pink.
That's awesome.
Well, Billy Carter in Minneapolis has put together a minuscule number. I think he's got one, maybe even a second of Doll Squad. He's got one that's projectable of Corpse Grinders and one of Blood Orgy. I don't know how projectable it is. I have zero prints, none of Ten Vala Women. I got beat out of them by a distributor who was not quite honorable. And so to this day, I've never had a print of Ten Vala Women. All of these prints took my life's work. You know, people, if I could, with $500,000, I could have a nice home, you know.
True.
And that was all for prints of movies, of which I had none.
Wow.
So it's a heavy story, but it's what you go through. You know, I think that anybody that does works of art, whether they're sculptures, we shot in a, you know, I'm shooting Astro Zombie M3 cloned, and that's going to be a real grindhouse match for Corpse Grinders and Mark of the Astro Zombies and Blood Orgy and the Cauldron. It's going to be a match, a dead ringer. But by the way, in Mark of the Astro Zombies, they just finished a week shooting in Florida. We call it my second unit, and a third unit in Sacramento is starting next week. So we're going to have input from Gary and Richard Lester, my dear friends in Daytona Beach, and they've invited us to have the world premiere there. We've got for the poster of the Astro Zombie M3 clone the Crystal Rio Award, awarded by the Florida Motion Picture and Television Association. So we've got invites already to have possibly a second world premiere, and we haven't even finished shooting yet. But there's enough PR going because of the internet now on Astro Zombie M3 cloned. It's really feels good to have people show that much interest. With Demon Haunt, I have not released it yet, strictly because I was thinking that with so much money at stake, I've got to have some sort of a cash advance. But I told Alpha, Steve Kaplan at Alpha Video, that sells under the name of oldies.com, I told them I'd rather deal with them, have all my movies in one house, and deal with a distributor who will come up with a few bucks and you never hear from them again. Because Alpha gives me reports properly and money when it's due. And, you know, it's nice to deal with a nice distribution company, really. So we don't have much more to shoot on Astro Zombie M3 cloned. And Corey Udler and I put our heads together, and then on starting to shoot, I decided that I'm changing the whole second half. So I've been shooting out of my head, so to speak. It makes me think of when I was a kid in my teens and early 20s. I'd call together everybody who wanted to be in a movie. Whoever showed up, I'd write down their names, and this would be on a Saturday morning, and I'd use a legal-sized envelope, and I'd write down the names, what I could put together, and I'd come up with a scheme, and we'd go shoot it and have it all done in 2 days. And that was 50 years ago, you know, or more. It was way back. I did 10 of those without ever showing them to anybody. I did those as my learning tools. Now kids get a hold of a little camera and a computer, and they think the world is going to be ready for their movie, you know. But what they have to know, it takes a number of those before they get smart enough to make an entertaining movie that holds.
Thank you.
But I made 10 of those that nobody to this day has ever seen, except the people that were helping me or in front of the camera or anybody that helped behind the camera. And some of those were quite extensive. We blew up a mountain one time, 25 sticks of dynamite, laid the whole half of a cliff over onto our actors who were chasing the guy that stole all the money. and to do that now would cost a mighty fortune, you know. I had people behind me then, and I did them all with no money. I used to buy outdated film from the drugstore that a 100-foot reel included processing for $4.
Wow.
Anyway, that's, of course, why I wouldn't try to do anything with those movies, but they sure were good teaching tools, and of course, there was no such thing as a moviola, and I spent 10 years doing that before I did Strike Me Deadly.
You know, that's a very smart thing, too, because when I first started, I didn't learn that lesson quite yet, and I'd done these movies with my friends, basically backyard fest, like what you're saying. We'd try to do the best we could. We were just friends, though. You know, we're just hanging around, you know, Kansas City trying to do this stuff. And Dave DeCoto put them out. And, of course, my friends are standing there. What am I going to say when he says, hey, you want me to put these out? I'm not going to say no. I'm going to, you know, my friends were like, let's do this. And then it took me 8 years to live that stuff down because it was so not ready for public consumption.
Well, you know,
yeah, but you sort of knew it wasn't ready for public consumption. Well, some of these guys can't get this stuff all the time.
It's better you don't put anything out if it's not right.
Well, that's what I mean, because I get these things with screeners. These guys go, well, what do you think? I said, honestly, if I told you what I really think, you'd never want to do this again, so maybe I should. But I try to give people constructive advice. But it's like, you know, it's like this guy gives me this thing, something about zombies. And it looks like he put more money into the cover than he did the whole movie. And he sort of he directed it, then he cast himself in the lead. And I'm like, you know something? I go, you really have to figure out what you really want to do and where your strengths are instead of being like all over the road. I mean, I hate to shoot anybody down because you don't know where the next, you know, genius is coming from, to be honest. And, you know it yourself. I mean, your whole breed was like, you know, guys like you, Dave Friedman, Herschel Gordon Lewis, that whole generation of filmmakers, I mean, you guys just took it and ran with it, and you made an impact. And, you know, everybody else thinks, well, I can do that too. And it's like, no, you can't, because it's not the same time period anymore.
Well, what really happened, there was a handful of us in Hollywood that were turning out 35mm. I was probably the only one who had acquired the cameras, the 35mm, you know, everything, moviolas and all. So that I could make them. I spent my money doing that instead of sitting around in a blues house getting drunk or joining golf clubs or whatever.
Right.
I spent my money on equipment, augers, and so I could go shoot, provided I could find raw stock. And so since I was officed right in the heart of all the studios and in the studios myself, I bought raw stock 35mm as low as a penny a foot in color. And nickel was quite average. So I have always made a joke out of, I've never been able to make a film yet with anything but used film. I had to use short ends, giving you a minute or 2 minutes, max 3 minutes at a time, running time. If the actor flubs his line on first two words, somebody's got to go back in the changing bag and put in another short end. But all of my movies were made with short ends. Never once did I get to use new film. Nobody understands when I say used film. When I explain it, of course, it's at the studios when they get down on a 1,000-foot reel down to 300 feet and they're not sure whether the next scene is going to take more than 3 minutes. They just throw in a new roll, and that 300-foot leftover film goes in a black bag, and then these guys take it home or whatever and sell it. Or if they're honorable, they leave it in the vaults at Paramount or MGM or wherever I'd get it from. And then I'd buy big chunks of it at a time and refrigerate it so it wouldn't go bad. But when I think about films like Corpse Grinders, we only got to film 1 to 2 minutes at a time. And now somebody with a little camcorder can turn it on and let it run for an hour. And boy, you know, you had to really ration. And you really had to have characters who could perform without flubbing their lines and wanting to start over like they can now. And of course, you know, right now, we'll do all the takes that we need to get the shot. But then you could not. You would do multiple takes, but very gingerly, you know. You really search it out. The lighting's got to be just right. But, you know, people ask me if I've seen all these guys. You know what? I don't have time to see anybody's movies. I get a lot of movies from young people who are making their own movie. I do take the time to look at those because they want feedback. And so I try to give my feedback. But like Pete said, very often it's hard to come up with words because you do not have anything that is marketable. And maybe on occasion somebody would come up with one, but I don't have time to view other people's movies. I mean, regular theatrical movies. I think I saw The English Patient a few years ago in a theater. That's the last one I saw.
But you know what? Using those short ends actually, I think, improved because, of course, you know, when you cut off that camera, you can't start it up again in the same position, so you'd have to change your angle. And the fact that you had to constantly change angles made the films faster paced visually. I mean, you don't have a guy sitting at a table pouring a glass of milk. You know?
That's true, but when somebody screws up and when you're taking the time to set up the shot, you put in another short end and do it the same in what we call pickup.
Yep.
So we'd say we'd be on scene 25 Apple, and then there'd be pickup one and pickup two. And on the movie I'm shooting right now, Astro Zombie M3 Clone, we had, since I made it up as we went, I'd have as many as six letters. Like, added scene would be A-S, and then the warehouse would be W-H, and then it would be S-C-1 Apple pickup two. So we'd have like 9 to 10 letters on a slate. And then, of course, that has to be documented so that when I go back to find it, I'll know what it is. But I use those letters as a clue as to where we are, warehouse being WH, added scene, meaning, you know, it wasn't in the script and made it up on the spot. And the number I would give it, if it was a new added scene in a new location, we'd have all that nomenclature there, the letters, and then we'd start with scene one, and then Apple, Baker, Charlie, David, so on like that. But anyway,
wow,
it's been a real treat to be doing Astro Zombie M3 Clone, because now I get to really play. I can run a camera as many takes as I wish, and of course getting people. When you're doing it this way, you know, I'm still having to go. When I have money and when I'm financed to a degree, I pay people. When I don't have money and I'm not finding any financing anywhere, borrows, loans, or whatever, I don't pay. So you have to make your shoots when the people are available. And very often, you can get two or three people in front of the camera out of four that are needed, but you can't get anybody to help on lights and so on behind the camera. Or I can get two or three people behind the camera, and the actors aren't available because they're working graveyard, or working daytimes, or working, you know, banker's hours, or whatever. But, you know, it goes together. I think we're going to have a hell of a good little movie in Astro Zombie M3 Clone, but it should complement. Even though I don't get anything off of the first Astro Zombie movie, I guess everybody knows by now that was sold out from under me after I spent 13 months on it for free, and then I never got a dime from all the work, all the showings, all the money that movie has made. So that's why I did Mark of the Astro Zombies, and ultimately it'll probably seek its own level of acceptance. And then Astro Zombie M3 Clone. And how I came up with that, driving to my studio one day, this is my third Astro Zombie movement. I'll call it Astro Zombie M Model 3 Clone, because we're going to clone them. And so I've had only that one title in mind since I wrote the script, is Astro Zombie M3 Clone in Area 51. And it's going to be funky, you know. It is campy. And yet there are sometimes serious moments in it. But it should be a good supplement to the first two of my Astro Zombie movies.
That's awesome.
I'll tell you, I've honestly never seen a picture of yours that I didn't like. There was always something, you know, to hold me into that thing, you know, and watch it, you know, from beginning to end, where other people are like, give me like my 15-minute rule and get into this and go, okay, I can't do this. But your stuff always managed to grab me and hold my attention, and maybe that's why it's
nice.
So enthralling.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I made that from the heart. I mean, really, I grew up with this stuff. And, like, I'm just wondering why nobody ever tried to remake The Corpse Grinders. It's a big budget picture.
Well, there's talk about it. I've got two or three people that talk about doing it. And somebody emailed me and then put in a phone number, and I called them. And they said, they've already shot 40 minutes of Corpse Grinders 3. Would I like to get involved? I emailed him back. I said, I don't know about shooting Corpse Grinders 3 without me. It doesn't seem right.
True.
So, anyway, there was talk. Patrick Hughes in Hollywood was told by somebody who worked in acquisitions at MGM when Patrick was finding a home for my movies with another company for a 3-year period that had never been involved in releasing movies before, so that was not a payoff deal. But anyway, the person there said, if you know Ted V. Michaels, You're a fool to think about putting money anywhere else. You go get it, lock it up, find $6 million to do Corpse Grinders 2 in order with somebody in it that's recognized. You will be successful. You'll make money. So this guy went to Quentin Tarantino, and I guess they had some chats about it, but Quentin, I guess, had a lot of opportunities in a lot of directions, and we never got off the ground with it, but it was discussed. Anyway, yeah, that's true, but in a way, I'd like to think, I get people asking me about a remake of every movie I've made. When I did Blood Orgy, The Cauldron, Baptism of Blood is the sequel. I've got people asking me when I'm going to do a sequel to Strike Me Deadly, because when I did that, I sold everything, my house, my car, and everything, to buy film, and all I could come up with was black and white film, the money for black and white film. American International, with Sam Markoff and all that, were going to buy it, but one of the guys on their board said, no, it's a time of color. You know, we can't, we're not going to take a chance. It's got to be color. So it didn't go, but it's still a dang fine movie. But I've had people ask me, what about a sequel to Strike Me Deadly? What about a sequel? When are you going to do a sequel to Ten Violent Women? I've got a guy in England right now. I've got to answer his interview questions maybe tonight or tomorrow. And but he wants a, he wanted maybe 10 who've asked me, am I ever going to do a sequel to Ten Violent Women? And so on. About the only one no one has asked me about making a sequel to is Mission Kill Fast, because how can you compete with Transporters and all that, you know, without a budget, without money? How can you?
True.
So, anyway.
I want to do a remake of Blood Orgy of the She-Devils, I swear. I love that title. It's one of the greatest titles of all time.
I made that in a blue period of my life. To write that, I had gone to seances with my friend Paul and Leslie McRae, who is the star of Girl in Gold Boots and so on. Anyway, they were deeply interested in seances and so on. So I went to another and I took notes. I took pages of notes. Then I began to read books on the paranormal, supernatural and all. And I had probably 2 years of notes and books. I decided, the hell with it. I'm going to go hide myself. I took an apartment at one of these places where young people, you know, you swim and all that, have workout rooms and steam rooms and all. So I took that room for a month and drove me to my cameras and all. So I just stayed on at 35. But that Blood Orgy of the She-Devils is the only movie I've ever made where I sat down and wrote the script, and I followed it because I was so overwhelmed with all the things that was going on in my personal life. I was the star of the castle. Anyway, what I did is I stuck to...
That's a good movie.
You know what? Out of the studio, I'm looking for stuff to take to the Palms because Fangoria is there at the end of this month, Halloween, and I'm a special guest there again. And I'm looking for my DVDs that I want to take and offer for sale. And I cannot find my boxes of T-shirts. Absolutely nowhere. And I've got T-shirts already on Astro Zombie, M3 Clone, with three big Astro Zombie heads on the front of the T-shirt. Marvel. I cannot find them.
Time for refreshment. Refreshment. For your enjoyment, there's hot, fresh popcorn. Tempting, delicious hot dogs. And so many kinds of ice cream. And, of course, sparkling, delicious ice-cold Coca-Cola for everybody at the refreshment counter now. Remember, your favorite snack will taste especially good with world-famous ice-cold Coca-Cola.
Somewhere in the dark of infinite space, there is a form of life that man has reason to fear. It is as old as the universe. It is real. It is evil. And now, it is here. William Devane, Kathy Lee Crosby, Richard Jacob, Keenan Wynn. The Dark, a chilling tale of alien terror. Rated R, restricted.
Astro Zombie, M3 Clone, Mark of the Astro Zombie. I don't have any of them if I don't find it. There's no way I could get them recreated. They were all usually somebody comes to me and said they want to make them. And would it be all right, or something to that effect? And then if you say yes, we'll give them to you for cost. So, but I don't even know who made them all now. So if I can't find them, we're out. But we're looking to have T-shirts of Astro Zombie M3 Clone. That's one. That's brand new by Unique Ink. Tim Smith at Unique Ink designed one there for me. It's a beautiful T-shirt. And they'll be there. They took a hiatus until the middle of October, but I think they could zap off a dozen or so for me in time for the show. But I know that I won't find any of the others. I don't know where they came from.
Wow.
Same as Astro Zombie Masks. What's his name in Pasadena? God, all of a sudden I can't think of his name. That's terrible. Made the masks for me. Jay Gowie, Monsters of Effects. Anyway, Jay Gowie made 8 masks for me. And now people are saying, okay, I want to buy a mask, the shirt with the emblem on, the Astro Zombies wore, a machete, the pair of gloves, and now they're almost all spoken for already, and we haven't even finished shooting yet because people want those, the complete set, you know. So I'll be lucky if I can hang on to the one I had to begin with.
That's awesome.
It's the Fangoria Weekend of Horrors thing in Vegas, right, that you're doing?
Yeah, that's the weekend. That's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the 30th, 31st, and 1st of November. My friend Kevin Smith, Kevin Michaels, Kevin Shawn Michaels, no relation, but he did that documentary on me with the input from Alexia Anastasiaso. Anyway, they did a beautiful a documentary on me, I don't know what, 80, 90 minutes, called The Wild World of Ted B. Michaels. And they're coming out, and John Waters has agreed. He did the narration on it for us, and I guess he's going to do a little thing with us there, PR. They're coming in from New York to be here for the show, and they'll have The Wild World of Ted B. Michaels. But after the first of the year, it will be coming out on oldies.com from Alpha Video. And then the book. They're out of print. Well, they're not out of print, but they're almost out of stock. And I don't know that they reprint that McFarlane Books. Let's see, it's called Film Alchemy, The Independent Cinema of Ted B. Michaels. I got a call from Hollywood yesterday. A woman got the book from Amazon, I guess, or direct from McFarlane, one of the two. And she was raving on. But that book by Christopher Curry did cover a lot of my activities, like when I was a stuntman and when I shot all the Flaming Arrows and Indian Fighter with Kirk Douglas and a lot of the things that people would have no way of knowing except through that book. And my, you know, my weightlifting days, it's probably why my back is shot right now. Anyway, weightlifting days and stunt riding and all that kind of stuff. Fencing, I did take on two Canadian, well, one was Canadian, one was American fencing champions, and I beat them. But I think it had to be, as I've often said, it had to be a carryover from a previous existence, a previous lifetime, where I may have been an expert fencer, because there's no reason for me to be able to beat a champion fencer with very little. I had, three lessons? But I loved the saber. I was very good on my legs. I could jump like a spider. And I could do a repartee and nail somebody even before they knew I was coming at them.
Wow.
But now my body is not quite as active as that anymore. What can one say?
That's true.
Fortunately, it happens. I'm feeling marvelous lately, too.
The one movie that hasn't had proper play that I made, both of the Alex Joseph and his wives, and Bill Thrush passed away, but there was so much controversy between Bill Thrush and Alex Joseph and the people involved, but, you know, I never got paid for producing and directing and editing and all that, so that's when I got to direct on horseback up in the mountains of Utah, where they did the cowboy movies and so on, and that's a dang fine movie for it not to be out. Another one is what I made for Jeff Hogue. I put that, actually, that was a heavy input, too. I spent a year lip-syncing every word because all the soundtracks got fragmentized, magnetized, going through evidently X-ray machines, and I had to re-sync the whole movie by recutting, in other words, re-transferring all the original Magra soundtracks onto 35, and then with multiple magnifying glasses, read people's lips to know, you know, how to put it in the sync, and that took me like 19 months from beginning to end, but who knows about Warcat, you know? Who knows about it? And when Jeff made a deal with somebody, I think it was Trans World or Trans America Video or Home Video, something happened. They screwed up the tracks. And so when their contract was, they went out of business and nobody picked up. But I've spent so much of my life doing these movies, and where are they, you know? And where's my money? Where's my money that didn't come? That's what the guy picked up on, yeah. Doing all that work, and now I'm broke. But he doesn't understand the movie business at all.
Well, honestly, you can go through phases where you're broke like one week, and then like the next week some money will come in, surprisingly, from a distributor overseas, and then all of a sudden you're broke again.
Well, that's true. But, you know, when you're in debt $500,000, you're broke for a while.
The other thing that the guy said that pissed you off was he said it's grade Z schlock.
Oh, boy. You know what? I'm going to make it a point. Anymore, at one time, I had made the arrangement that I had to view anything that was printed or put out, and which is the arrangement I made for Kevin Shawn Michaels when they did the documentary on me. So I get to approve the same as the book. I want to approve of everything that was said. And now in the future, I'm not going to grant interviews unless people have seen at least a half a dozen of my movies, are totally familiar with my work, and agree in writing not to use the word schlock, trash, schlockmeister, because usually these people have never seen the movies. They're just going by some smart-aleck college kid who thought he could make movies and calls everybody else's schlock and trash, so these guys pick up on that. And I'm not going to tolerate it.
Yeah, but schlock and trash, why is it still around? Why is it still so enduring? Why do people still want to see it?
John Landis named his movie Schlock because that's what they were calling the movies he loved so much as a kid. And so when he made that movie with the gorilla, you know, Rick Baker worked on it, John said, let's call this Schlock, because that's exactly what it is. When someone tells me, hey, man, that's a schlocky movie, I'm immediately going to watch it because those are the movies I love, the ones that people call that. So, you know, it is a bad term in one's way, but in another way, to those of us that love it, it's become a term of endearment.
That's true. That's true. I've had, what the heck was the guy that died recently, made well-known, he had big posters at the shows, especially at Cinema Wasteland in Atlanta. He died just recently in a big home. He was trying to borrow $30,000 or something, couldn't get it. You know who I'm talking about? Anyway, he actually went to Australia, and he said everybody was calling his movies trash. And he said, I really got upset until they explained to me that that was a term of endearment to them. When they got called trash, they were really loved them.
That's it.
So I guess he got past that. But it's still, you know, it's still to the uninformed, like the people, like my own family hasn't seen my movies because, you know, if anybody writes anything trash, schlock, schlockmeister, Z grade, no budget, you know, they don't want to, there's no pride in their brother's work when they have to read anything like that. They don't understand it.
Yeah.
They're not of an age that they identify with people who love trash movies.
Well, you know, Roger Corman once said, and I know you talked about Roger earlier, but one of the few times I've got to talk to Roger, he once said, look, they can call my movies trash all they want because that trash has made me more money than their pretentious, big-budget, ridiculous melodrama will ever make them. So they let them keep calling it that. And I said to Roger, well, you know, when I hear the word trash cinema, as a matter of fact, I buy a book called Trash Cinema, a magazine, because of the fact that the people I love's movies are in there. It's not ridiculous, pandering art movies like The Reader. I mean, who wants to see that?
Yeah, really. Well, there's a lot of truth in what you say. It's just as you grow up and when you make your movies when you're young, and you know, when you're 18 and 20 and even 30 and whatever, if people badmouth your movie and call them junk or trash, you'd probably punch them in the mouth. But now it is a term of endearment. And it's still not that easy to accept because you'd like to have people say, I enjoyed this movie for this reason or that reason, or it was fun to watch, or, you know, one lady at the bank recently, a girl I just met at the bank, and she said, she didn't say it to me, but she said it to the bank manager, I love Ted's movies. They tell a story. They have a beginning, a middle, and they end with something, and you can understand them, and they're great. So Anyway, after the manager told me that, I asked her if she wanted to be a Doll Squad girl, so she'll be a Doll Squad in the last of the shooting here.
That's awesome.
Anyway.
Ted, anything you want to push? I know you're going to be at Fango. Any other appearances? Anything else going on?
Well, I get a lot of requests for appearances. I think I mentioned the Florida Motion Picture and Television Association has invited us there for a world premiere, you know, all expenses paid and living in top quarters and all that. And I'm sorry, I don't know if you guys hear that sound at the beep in, but in any event, good. And plus the fact that I'm still waiting for some of the movies that haven't really made it up there yet, like Corpse 2, Corpse Grinders 2, is a good, fun movie, you know. And Mark of the Astro Zombies is a fun, funky, and a fun movie. And I'm hoping that they will take their place along with the original Corpse Grinders or the original Astro Zombies or whatever. And whether I'll get around to making more sequences will depend on the worldwide economy, because if these countries don't begin buying American films again when they have money to spend, you know, like all my movies used to go everywhere in the world, even Bangladesh would buy, and Spain and Belgium and Germany and Italy and Japan, South Korea, they all years ago would buy my movies. Now none of them have any money.
True.
And if they do, they've got a quota, and they only want to bring in the $100 million movies because they're a proven factor, a proven product. So in any event, when the economy changes and comes back in our favor, then maybe there'll be something we can do to think about making more sequels or originals.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to Demon Haunt and Astro Zombies 3, MP3 Clone, right?
AZ, for sure they call it AZ M3 Cloned, Astro Zombies M3 Cloned. But if you go to my website, you'll see the poster. It's the one on the website doesn't have all the credits on it, but the poster that we got, the equivalent, they say, the equivalent of the Academy Award from the Florida Motion Picture and Television Association is for that poster, Astro Zombie M3 Cloned. It is a gripping poster. It's good.
Wow.
And I've seen clips from Demon Haunt. That looks outstanding, too. I can't wait to see
that. Well, there's a lot of hard work in the CGI. The CGI in there took a year and a half or so, and that was difficult. And in the CGI, I had gone to England with my dear friend Shanti, and we filmed a lot of the places where she grew up. She knew where they all were, the abbeys and all that. And I shot a lot of footage, and that's what my dear friend Mac in the studio used for the basis of the CGI, where we've got demonic entities flying through these old castle walls and all that sort of thing. It was a heavy undertaking, Demon Haunt, and I hope it will take its place, and as soon as it gets a release that people will get behind it, I think it will. Well, it's been really nice talking to you gentlemen, and
Ted, it's been a pleasure having you on. We'll have to have you back again. And
Todd, it's been nice talking with you. And Pete, I've appreciated your friendship over the years so much. You're a very dear person.
He is. He's a gem. He's a diamond in the rough, or he's a rough in the diamond.
He sure is. And he was that way from the first moment we met.
And that's it for this week. And we'll be back next week, maybe with a little surprise guest. So keep your fingers crossed. Stay sick.
Forty-Second Street Pete's Grindhouse is a production of Jackalope 105 FM.
Do you feel that? Oh, shit. Oh, wah-ah-ah-ah. Wah-ah-ah-ah. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up. Come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You fucker, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Madness is the gift that has been given to me. I can see inside you the sickness is rising. It seems that all that was good has died. Oh no, the world is a scary place. Now that you've woken up the demon
in me.
Bobby, will you give it to me?
2, 3, 4.
Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You fucker, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Why can't you just fuck off and die? Get down with the sickness. Fuck you, I don't need this shit. I'm down with the sickness. You stupid, sadistic, abusive fucking organ. Down with the sickness. Here it comes. Get ready to die. Get ready to
die.
Come on, here we go again, motherfucker, yeah, yeah, yeah. Come on down and see the idiot right here, too fucked to beg and not afraid to care. What's the matter with calamity anyway? Right, get the fuck out of my face. Understand I can't feel anything, it isn't like I want to sift through the decay. I feel like a wound, like I got a fucking gun against my head. You live when I'm dead. People equal shit. People equal shit. People equal shit. People equal shit. Come on. Me now, so fuck it. Blood on my face and my hands, I don't know why. I'm not afraid to cry, but that is none of your business. Overdo it, don't tell me you blew it. Stop your bitching and fight your way through it. I'm not like you, I just fuck up. Come on, motherfucker, everybody has to die. People equal shit.
Shit.
People equal shit.